March 3rd, 2026, Magha Puja evening. Normally, Magha Puja falls on the full moon of February, someplace in February, but then this is about as late as it gets. Sometimes it's just in the beginning of March. Next year, it'll probably be quite a bit earlier. And so it is fairly late this year. And I just got back from Thailand a couple days ago. 2 days ago, got back to Ubaya Giri around 10 p.m. So normally wouldn't want to leave during the winter retreat, but it's the only time they offer these Upajaya exams, these preceptor exams. So it's kind of a one-off, and leaving during the winter retreat and coming back in March. And tomorrow I'll have a chance to enter a period of solitary retreat until the end of the winter retreat. Much needed. I've been really involved in a lot of activity, and really Ubaya Giri is, in terms of noise, Ubaya Giri is certainly the opposite of what I was just part of, these huge monastic institutions in Thailand. And so I'm very much appreciating being back here in the forest. It's very, very quiet, incredibly quiet. In kind of springtime, it's just really ideal weather, perfect time to be here. And the Magha Puja day is the day when 1,250 arahants came together spontaneously in order to see the Buddha, pay respects. It occurred about a year after the Buddha's enlightenment. There was 1,250 or more than that arahants by that time. And 1,000 of them would have been the former fire ascetics, the Kassapa brothers and their entourage, among others. So they came together, and then the Buddha gave a exhortation about just the basics of the holy life, the basics of how to live a skillful life. And so when we think 1,250 arahants, I like to think 1,250 people who aren't worried about anything coming together, 1,250 people who aren't making an issue out of anything, 1,250 people who aren't making a problem out of anything, 1,250 people who are able to be at ease. We say the word arhant, it can be quite obscure or vague, not really clear what it means. We can think 1,250 people who aren't suffering, 1,250 people who aren't any longer enmeshed in the world or caught by the world, been able to free themselves, abide content, at ease, without worries, with a mind and heart that's cool and peaceful. So if we can imagine a large group of people like that coming together, and also just reflecting on the word arahant, it's not just our tradition, but in general in the practice traditions, then you don't really talk about this too much. We don't make claims to these things. We don't really necessarily talk about them. And sometimes we would like to think, oh, I wonder who a stream enter, I wonder which one is a stream enter, I wonder who the stream enters are. Are there any arhants? Wonder who an arhant is. This or that one might, they claim to be an arhant. Are they really an arhant? So, in my travels, I had the opportunity to, in Christmas time, I went to Malaysia, had the opportunity to meet up with Longpa here, and he was in Malaysia heading back here. So it was, I had a chance to check in, pay respects. And then after that, there was a Longpa Cha Remembrance Day there in Malaysia, which was very nice. And after that, I had a chance to go to Singapore for 5 days, which was my first time in Singapore. And when I was there, I had the opportunity to meet up with a monk who I'd heard a lot about but never really met up with before, Longpa Tongdeng. And he's a disciple of Longpa Plien. And so I had a chance to go to a couple of meal invitations with him. It was very nice. And one of them, there was a chance for a Q&A with the lay people, so I just was there listening. And somebody asked a question, oh, when you were living with Longpa Plien, then did he ever reveal to you his attainments? Did he ever reveal to you his attainments? And so Longpo Tongdang, he's considered one of the closest, if not the closest, student of Longpo Plien. And Longpo Tongdang said, no, he never talked about it. He never talked about it with me. I found that incredibly inspiring. He said, no, he never talked about his attainments with me. And he said, but what I do know is I never, ever saw him get angry, even a single time. And he was only kind. I only saw him exhibit kindness and metta. Never saw him get angry, irritated, frustrated, even a single time. And that gave him confidence. So for me, that exhibits a special quality that even close disciples, close students, their teacher didn't reveal necessarily, like their level of Dhamma, like I am this, I am that, I am have this level of Dhamma, that level of Dhamma, this attainment, that attainment. And in a way that exhibits really the highest levels of practice, that sense of humility. And it's not at all about getting something or attaining something. It's just, how can we live in a way that is free of worries, free of issues, not creating problems out of anything, and free of suffering, ultimately free of suffering, at ease. So how can we be free of suffering? What can we do to be free of suffering? And that those qualities of kindness, metta, no matter what, that was exhibited by Longpo Plien. So I found that incredibly inspiring, just listening, just sitting there listening to that. So when these 1,250 beings with pure minds came together, then the Buddha just, he gave a teaching, although perhaps you could say they didn't need any further teachings, but the Buddha just gave advice around how to live a very pure life, a very wholesome life, and really basic teachings around knowing the right measure with eating and resting, knowing how to be kind to each other, not being divisive or harsh with each other, being very, very harmonious, living in a harmonious way, and cultivating a sense of solitude, commitment to the higher mind, adi chitte cha yogo. That's a commitment or a binding oneself to the striving for the mind which is lofty and above the world. And this is what all the Buddhas teach, says this very, very basic teaching, very simple teaching. The teaching starts out with the commitment to the wholesome, relinquishing that which is unwholesome, that which is not good. And there's this phrase, kanti paramang tapotitika, and then followed by nibbanang paramang vadanti buddha. So these are two phrases that use the word paramang, which means highest or greatest. And like the paramatta dhamma would be the highest dhamma or the supreme dhamma. You could translate it as supreme. Kanti paramang tapotitika would be tapas, is fire. That would be considered spiritual fire. That would be cultivated by ascetics, by tapasins. That would be practicing in a way perhaps of depriving themselves of any comforts. And we could even call it self-mortification in order to build up a spiritual fire and develop certain powers and try to purify the mind in that way. And the Buddha, we have to remember that he's talking to the 1,000 former fire ascetics as well, who used to practice those things. So kanti paramang tapo titika, that's the patient endurance. Kanti is patience. Patient endurance is the supreme tapas, the supreme way to burn out the mental defilements, the obscurations. In Thai, kanti is translated as ot ton. It's two words. And this is a very far-reaching concept, a far-reaching idea. Ot means to go without. So ot deals with what we like. There might be things that we like that, based on the precepts or based on the cultivation of that which is wholesome, say we might like to drink alcohol, for example, is a very easy example. Ot would be to go without, because we see the benefit. Ton means to endure. So ton deals with that which is unpleasant. So ot deals with that which is pleasant, which we go without. Ton is that which is unpleasant, which we come into contact with, which we endure. So ot ton tends to be translated as patient endurance. We could also think of it as going without and enduring. So this, we can always be content if we have this quality of kanti, this quality of patient endurance, then the mind can always find a way forward. The mind can always endure the difficulties that are arising, whether we hear about difficult things in the news or wars or whatever, then we might suffer considerably over this or feel a sense of mental torment and frustration. And this is only natural. Ton, this is ton. So we endure. This is something unpleasant. And we endure. We find a way forward. And then it also comes back to the Four Noble Truths, this sense of patient endurance, that the First Noble Truth, there is suffering. That's not at all personal. That's not there is my suffering or there is your suffering. Just there is suffering. It's everywhere. There is suffering. And then there's the dukkha samudaya. There's the cause of suffering. There is something. It doesn't just happen randomly, and it comes from craving. It comes from craving for sensuality, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming is the standard translations. I've also heard a Thai reframing of that, in that the kama tanha is the craving for sensuality, bhava tanha is the form realm, and vibhava tanha is the formless realm. So it deals with the three realms of existence which make up samsara. Was it Lumpur Khun taught last year when he visited? That was his formulation of kama tanha, bhava tanha, and vibhava tanha. So like bhava tanha would be desire for the form, and vibhava tanha is desire for the formless. Another way of thinking about it, which encompasses all of existence, everything possible in existence. So when we come back to this cause of suffering, that craving, and then I tend to try to stress this point over and over again. I feel like I can't say it enough, that the cause of suffering is not anything else other than those things. So, but then we should ask ourselves, what do we think in our everyday life? What do we assume is causing our suffering? Because we think about ignorance or delusion, all it is a set of unquestioned assumptions that we're living our life by. Ignorance and delusion is a set of unquestioned assumptions which we are all living our lives by. So we think the cause of suffering is war. The cause of suffering is sickness. The cause of suffering is the person eating too loudly sitting next to me. The cause of suffering is this place. The cause of suffering is the person in the kitchen who won't keep noble silence. That's the cause of suffering. The cause of suffering is there's not enough happening here. There's needs to be more happening. The cause of suffering is there's too much happening here. The cause of suffering is my knees hurt. The cause of suffering is my back hurts, or anything. You say the cause of suffering is somebody looked at me in a way which I didn't like. So coming back to the cause of suffering is craving. We could even say craving for these things to be otherwise. Now, when we have patient endurance, that really allows us to, it helps us to see those things more clearly. And it also helps us to step back and say to ourselves, wait a minute, what are these assumptions that my mind is making? That's the contemplation of a practitioner. So for us practitioners, we, by habit, we become very reflective. We reflect on our experience. We create that habit of just considering these things and stepping back and saying, oh, is that really the case? Or maybe it's this way, and I can think about it. I can contemplate it. Is that really the cause of suffering currently, of my suffering that I'm experiencing? Is that the cause of this frustration and tension that I'm experiencing? Or is there some sort of assumption in my mind that I'm not questioning? So we reflect on this, and we all of us who have been practicing, we develop this habit of having a reflective mind. For people who don't practice, then it's going to be just automatic knee-jerk reactions. And those assumptions aren't even going to be reflected on. And when we practice, sometimes we'll get the question, us ajahns, people will ask us the question, oh, I know this or that person and they don't practice. And what do I do when they criticize me or when they get upset about this or that? And it's just, we can't expect that people who don't reflect on their own behavior are going to ever have insight into it. So that's something we just have to auton. We just have to endure that, oh yeah, that's only natural, and we shouldn't hold it against people. We shouldn't hold it against people that if they aren't practicing, that they're going to have these automatic reactions to experience. That's only natural. And it's just the way it is when one doesn't reflect on one's experience, when one doesn't acknowledge that there is the wholesome and the unwholesome, and there is this practice which can take place in order to help purify the mind. So we need to also, in order to develop our own wholesome qualities, be very forgiving with people. People have different views or assumptions about the world or about anything, about religion, about existence, and so on, about heaven, about whether there is another life or not. You know, if people have different assumptions or views than us, then we just can accept that because that's just the way it is. And then we just look at our own practice, look at our own experience. There's also the cessation of suffering. So it comes through the relinquishment. So it's an intention to be at ease, an intention to relinquish. There has to be that conscious intention there. It's not just going to happen automatically. And this also comes about through being willing to think over things and consider things. Even in the meditation is not about stopping thinking. The mind will settle naturally when the right causes and conditions are in place. But in the meditation, we're allowed to think about things and consider things in order to help the mind, coax the mind into settling. Or we could even say coaxing the mind into just being content and happy and just having a sense of well-being, because the settling's not going to happen if the mind's not happy. If the mind is full of frustration and suffering, then it's not going to settle. And we can't force the mind to settle, because if we try to force things, then that's going to make the mind more hot and frustrated. And so the Buddha said the happy mind is easily concentrated. The happiness comes before the concentration. Happiness is the precursor to samadhi. So then the question is, how do we make the mind happy? What can we do to help the mind to be happy and content? If the mind is experiencing a lot of suffering, then of course it's not going to be settled, because it's going to be running back and forth looking for a way out of that suffering. It's going to be trying to find some way to get out of it. And if it doesn't know how to get out of suffering, then it's going to seek all sorts of distractions and just try to escape in any way that it knows. It's going to have all sorts of default reactions to that suffering, and it's not going to be peaceful. But if the mind is already happy and content and at ease, then I think of it as, you know, devas delight in their seats. They don't want to get up from their seat. They're happy just to sit in their seat. So if we can delight in our seat, delight where we're at, delight in the present moment, then the mind will naturally settle, because the mind's not trying to get away anywhere else. So of course it's going to settle. So how to bring gladness to the mind, how to gladden the mind, how to bring happiness to the mind. And that comes through precepts and sila, when the mind has a sense of no regrets and the mind is always refreshed, because there's nothing that we've done that is cause for concern, cause for fear, cause for agitation. Then the mind can be happy and content. And also we have this quality of abhayadana. So if we're very cultivate a forgiving attitude. And actually, it is difficult to forgive, really forgive, if we have an issue with somebody or a long-term resentment that's built up over time. Then it is very, very difficult to truly forgive. But if we make it conscious and we do try to have a mind that is very forgiving of people, if we get mistreated or we get treated unfairly and so on, or forgiving ourselves for making mistakes in the past, for treating others unfairly, and we realize it later. So we need to cultivate that sense of being able to forgive ourselves and move on. That's another way to gladden the mind, and gladdening the mind through generosity. So we can gladden the mind through generosity, and anybody who is very generous, you can see there's a brightness there. And so that's a way to gladden the mind, as well as a sila, dana, abhaya dana, all sorts of generosity. Then that can gladden the mind, and that will lead to settling. And I can remember times at Abhayagiri where some of my most pleasant meditation experiences were after doing a lot of dana. And I remember setting up one of these solar systems and working all day and thinking I was really, really tired. And then there was evening puja. It was during the Vasa. And years ago, this is probably 15 years ago or longer, maybe even 20 years ago, we would sit up on the ordination platform during the Vasa. We'd do our morning and evening puja up there. So we did the evening puja up there, and I was really tired. But then, you know, I wasn't really expecting anything from the meditation, and it was good. It was a good experience. So that sense of really just doing the practice, and when we do dana and we let go of our own preferences, and then when we meditate, those same qualities are going to come into the meditation. It's only natural. So kanti paramang tapotitika nibbanang paramang vadanti buddha, that the Buddhas say nibbana is supreme. So that's coming after tapas, which is hot, burning and burning. Then nibbana is the cooling, the ultimate cooling is the highest, say the Buddhas. Then one who injures or does harm to others or is a burden on others isn't one gone forth, is not to act in that way, and so on. The restraint, according to the Patimokkha, or we could say any level of sila that we're taking on, according to training standards, having some sort of standards for our lives. This is a way to purity. This is the path to purity. This is what the Buddhas teach. Matanyuta is the right measure. Matanyuta cha bata saming, knowing the right measure at the meal. That's not too much, not too little, just knowing what works for us, knowing the right amount. And commitment to solitude. And coming back to that story about Lungpur Tongdang, talking about his teacher, Lungpur Plien. So in this Upajaya training, I had to learn the Anusasana, the end chants of the ordination, and the fourth Akaraniyakicha, which is the four things never to be done by one gone forth. The fourth one is one is not supposed to make a claim to a superior human state that one knows is not present in oneself. This is the fourth parajika. So if a bhikkhu makes a claim to a superior human state that they know they don't have, then it's a defeat offense. One is no longer a bhikkhu. But in the Anusasana, the ordination, it's worded differently. So there's the first part of the paragraph will say, this is what's never to be done. And then it'll say the ideal version of it. So it's like a false claim to a superior human state is never to be done. And the next sentence says, even so much as saying, I delight in an empty dwelling. So that's like the ideal. Saying I delight in an empty dwelling is not a parajika, but that's the ideal. So one is not to make a claim to a superior human state, even to the extent of saying, I delight in an empty dwelling. So it's that whole intention of me, of me, and I do this, look at me. That it's just flying in that face, that whole intention, and right off the bat, in the ordination, developing a strong sense of humility and being able to look inward and not just assume that we are this or we are that, but that we're able to develop that reflective attitude of, oh, let's just have an unassuming attitude about things and just be able to look at things closely. So it's quite wonderful that so many have come together this evening at Abayagiri for the Maga Puja evening. And the next part of the ceremony is that there will be an announcement, which I will do, recite a line, and then everybody can repeat after me, which is a reflection about the Maga Puja and what happened on this day, and about these different pure beings coming together. After the announcement, then we will light our candles and incense, and we'll take our candles, flowers, and incense and do a circumambulation 3 times of the cloister area outside, and then offer our incense into the incenser, the Green Buddha. So I'll end the talk there. That's enough for the time allotted. So wish everybody well, and we can end the talk before doing the announcement.